flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of U.S. soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines, and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded U.S. troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the U.S. due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European Commissioner and Foreign Minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša's participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stop their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report. It highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardment of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found a coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list, not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollar, not the loss of innocent human lives.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, last Wednesday. No guard was injured in the attack. Officials have not yet explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. They have not said anything about the possible motive behind the assassination either. Haitian police say 28 people were involved in the attack. 3 are Haitian Americans who have been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. On Monday, Haitian police said they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used a Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill the president. Washington has said the evidence provided by the Haitian authorities indicates that the assassination plot was at least partly hatched in the United States. Meanwhile, American television CNN said several of the men involved in Moïse's assassination were previously working as U.S. law enforcement informants. CNN cited people briefed on the matter. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration told it that at least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the administration. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. However, the FBI said in response to CNN's reporting that it doesn't comment on informants. A simple history check reveals deep U.S. involvement in Haiti. In 1915, following the assassination of the then Haitian president, the U.S. sent Marines into the tiny island nation. Washington gained complete control over the Haitian finances and the right to intervene there whenever the U.S. government deemed it necessary. This occupation continued until 1934. With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve peace and stability as it goes through this transformation.
Disgusting scenes coincided with England's historic defeat against Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition, as fights, vandalism, and racism were recorded both before and after full time. The majority of the racism was online and aimed at 3 black players who failed to score vital penalty kicks, costing England the game. The flood of hate forced even the Prime Minister to speak out against it.
major clean-up operations taking place just outside Wembley Stadium after the scenes we saw. Many would have hoped that we would have seen an end to hooliganism in the football industry. It was once dubbed the English disease, but it appears after the scenes we saw yesterday that we have some way to go before we can class the English disease as being totally extinct from the industry.
Footage recorded outside the stadium showed mobs of ticketless fans storm past the gates, gaining illegal entry, only to be met by a rival mob of fans fighting to keep them out. While the once clean streets of central London was turned into a giant rubbish tip by frustrated fans lashing out.
The reaction from England fans was both entirely predictable and in keeping with long-standing English traditions of extreme violence and disorder upon defeat. I mean, to support England means to support this sort of behaviour. I think it's an essential part of the supporter culture of the national team. You know, you can't really get more English than spiteful violence to make up for one's own deficiencies. The authorities don't exist to protect minorities, but to punish us. And what I found more disturbing was the number of black and brown people supporting England, you know, out of ignorance, a misplaced sense of identity, self-hatred. This should be a wake-up call for them.
These actions have now led to a Football Association review of England's conduct and condemnation by the London Metropolitan Police. However, if fans can't be properly held in check, England could risk major fines or even be banned from competing in the future. Robert Carter, London. Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the U.S. and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK, received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered. Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Purizap, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Welcome to Spotlight, addressing an OPCW meeting. Syria's mission to the UN body said, the actions of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog contradicts the principles of impartiality, since the United States has the largest chemical arsenal in the world, and the munitions pose a grave threat to international peace and security. The US, France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. This is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the U.S. and the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ami, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, welcome to the program. Please tell us more about these recent comments coming from Damascus.
Yes, actually, the comments were from came out from the head of Syria's mission at the OPCW in a meeting there. Raniel Rifai said that the OPCW has turned from a technical organization into a political tool in the hands of the United States, France, Britain, and other Western countries that have been implementing policies in line with the U.S. ones in order to pressure Syria and falsely accuse it various accusations such as still having chemical weapons over here. Now, also, Rania Rifai said that Syria fulfilled all of its commitments when it joined the OPCW back in 2013. And of course, we all remember how the international community acknowledged that Syria destroyed all of its chemical weapons. However, we still continue to hear accusations by the West that Syria still has chemical substances. Now, we also have to point out that head of Syria's mission, Rania Rifai, also criticized those claims by the United States and its allies that claim that Syria has chemical weapons, saying that those are lies and fabrications. Also, a very important point is Syria always argues and asks a question. Whenever those countries accuse Syria within a state of a advancing against terrorists. So there's a question. Why would a country like Syria use chemical weapons when, one, it has no chemical weapons, two, the ordinary weapons were doing the job against the terrorists?
All right, thanks a lot. Mohammed Ali joining us from Damascus. Let's take a look at our guests for tonight's Spotlight. We have veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia, North Africa, Mr. Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. And also expert on West Asian affairs and former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joins us from Manchester. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. Sir, Syria says that the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog is no longer a technical organization, but a political tool in the hands of the United States, the UK, and France to exert pressure on Damascus. How do you view these comments?
Yes, sadly, I have to agree 100% with that take on the OPCW. It's a tragedy that this very important international monitoring body should be corrupted in this way by being politicized by Western powers. The OPCW should be playing an impartial role and should be seen to be extremely impartial, but for the last few years, in decision after decision, it has shown that it is a puppet of the Western powers. Now, Britain and America in particular are responsible here. They have stuffed this organization with seconded officials from their own administrations who do not respect the impartiality of the OPCW but carry out the wishes of their masters in Washington and London. And this is basically why the OPCW is well on the way to being completely discredited.
Well, the organization's first president, Brazilian diplomat José Bustani, he backed and expressed his grave concerns over the tampering of the 2018 Duma report, fearing that the OPCW had become a tool of the U.S. government. Give us your take on those comments from the former head of the organization. Those are pretty much identical to what Damascus is saying right now.
Well, he's absolutely right, Mr. Bustani, and he's well placed to know, given his previous position. I'm afraid in the UN system, and I used to work in the UN after I left the British diplomatic service, I'm afraid in today's UN, if you don't follow the US narrative on important issues, you will never get to be Director General of an organization like OPCW. This organization and other agencies of the UN have become highly politicized by the Western powers just in the last 15 years. And he's absolutely correct that the initial report done by the technical inspectors who went to Duma produced a clear conclusion that there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. And this report was, once it got to headquarters in The Hague, was doctored by the Western officials working within the office of the Director General to produce the opposite conclusion. Why? Well, in order to justify the bombing of Syria, which had taken place even without waiting for the investigation by the US, by the OPCW inspectors.
Let's cross over now to Elijah Magnier in Brussels. Mr. Magnier, revelations, they suggest that the OPCW may have intentionally doctored its findings about the alleged gas attacks in Syria. The scandal, as we know, continued to grow throughout 2020 as OPCW experts. They came forward, they gave testimony as to how their findings had been completely manipulated or ignored in order to present a one-sided or quote-unquote incorrect view of events in order to further an agenda. Is that what Damascus meant when it repeatedly urged the chemical weapons watchdog to avoid politicizing Syrian issues?
Indeed, as your guest said, rightly said, the OPCW is politicized, and when Jose Bustani came out with his narrative saying that we are the inspectors of technical and scientists, and according to the scientist opinion, there is no chemical attack on Douma. And the reason why the OPCW is insisting is to justify the US, UK, and France attack on Damascus. And the whole world watched how the OPCW is lacking trust these days, particularly after the Douma attack. And it is obvious that a lot of pressure was put on the organization that needs honest watchdog and need honest observer and scientist to go on the site and tell us what's happening, but without taking a side and without being doctrinized by the superpower or the US or the UK opinion. Otherwise, there is no need for them to go and inspect on the ground if the decision is made before the attack.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Magnier. Why would the OPCW, even under pressure, suppress information and its findings? Just thinking about the consequences, what would this do to the body's credibility?
The aim was to attack President Assad that was winning a large part of Syria and freeing most of his territory. And when the international community that worked very hard to overthrow President Assad and allow Al-Qaeda and ISIS to gain territory, notwithstanding the huge investment that the Western countries and many Gulf countries, including Turkey, invested in Syria, it was just an excuse to look for, to bomb President Assad, even though everybody knows that at the time of the bombing in 2018, it was too late to change the balance on the ground. So bombing for bombing, it didn't make any sense. And regardless, the US, UK, and France went ahead and bombed three positions, and they told us that they were chemical sites. I mean, how can you bomb chemical sites and not risk the spread of chemical products and material in the air that can affect everybody, including civilians in Syria? It didn't make absolutely no sense.
Peter Ford, Damascus, along with Russia, have said in the past that chemical attacks had been staged in Syria in order to incriminate Damascus. There are a lot of arguments that Douma was a false flag attack. Who benefits from these actions? The cover-ups, the alleged false flag attacks, who gains from all of this?
The Western powers and the so-called rebels, obviously. The Western powers needed to justify their illegal bombing of Syria. That's why they can never admit that it was carried out on the basis of a falsehood. That's why they must continue to sustain this lie. But there's another deeper, more topical reason. They have to justify the continuing war on Syria, which mainly takes the form of economic warfare. In the shape of sanctions and withholding reconstruction assistance. In order to continue these cruel sanctions, which penalize and punish the ordinary Syrian people, the Western powers have to maintain the narrative that Assad is the president who gasses his people. So this piece of fakery is the cornerstone of the propaganda strategy which underpins the economic warfare on Syria, and that continues, and that's why they continue to hound Syria over this non-issue of chemical weapons.
Elijah Magnier, same question to you. If you recall, Russia recently warned of possible upcoming false flag attacks to maybe justify exerting more pressure on Damascus. who actually benefits from all of this?
Well, as Peter rightly said, the only beneficial is just to keep sustaining the narrative of what the U.S. is offering us, including the EU, to impose sanctions on Syria. And now the U.S. and the EU don't have any politics or any strategy to carry on in Syria. All their options are bad from their point of view. So what they are doing is to starve the population and thinking that maybe with sanctions they can curb the public opinion and turn it against President Assad, or perhaps they force Assad to come and negotiate with them. And this is not going to happen. The people are getting used to very harsh sanctions, and they are suffering. The local currency is devalued. All the goods are extremely unaffordable for everybody in Syria. And what the only benefit is, just because the Americans don't have any clear policy, they don't know what to do, to stay or to leave. So what they do is they maintain the sanction under very different excuses, including the chemical attack.
Peter Ford, there were a lot of, with the scandal coming out of the Douma attack, there was a lot of calls for reinvestigating the evidence instead of reopening the investigation into places like Douma. The OPCW took a step further and suspended Syria's rights at the weapons watchdog, citing a lack of cooperation. The question is, why should Syria cooperate with the OPCW at all?
That's a very good and fair question. The OPCW, since Douma, has the Americans and the British and the French have tried to give new powers and create new investigating committees and groups and sub-bodies over which they themselves will have more control, all in order to keep up the pressure on Syria and, to some extent, Russia, and to keep trying to exploit this issue. But the fact remains that the inspectors have only been able to carry out one proper investigation into an alleged site of an alleged use of chemical weapons, and that was Douma. And in that case, the first group of scientists and technical experts found that there was no evidence of a chemical attack. And this is why the Western powers have to keep trying to create new groups which will be more amenable to manipulation. It's no wonder that Syria simply refuses to have anything to do with them. They're illegal anyway. They've been set up, these new investigative bodies, they've been set up illegally in terms of UN law.
Elijah Magnier, when the OPCW scandals were unfolding, one journalist took to social media writing that this should be a global scandal. Quote, the suppression of evidence from experts from the OPCW in order to push for war in Syria. This cover-up was ignored by mainstream media. Why was it ignored?
Because there is no accountability for whatever superpower and countries like the US, UK, and France are doing in Syria. Their presence is illegal, and the mainstream media is supporting them because they've been bombarded by the necessity to remove President Assad from power. Everybody has adopted this narrative, and the consequences were unimportant. At the end of the day, after 11 years or 10 years of war, the President Assad is still in power and the Syrian government is stable. Now they're not willing to back off and change the narrative. This is why they don't care about scandal. If the OPCW has lost credibility or not, all world leaders have lost credibility in Syria, not only in Syria, even in other parts of the Middle East. Therefore, this is no longer something that we can, those searching for the truth or voicing the truth, can do much about it, at the exception of just mentioning it and just saying it. And the other side is just even closing their eyes or keeping pursuing the same narrative.
Peter Ford, one last question for you. Here's a concerning thought. If the likes of the U.S., the U.K., France, etc., they can pressure the OPCW for their own agendas, then they could very well be doing the same with other international bodies, too. Give us your final thoughts.
Absolutely. And thankfully, much of the world is waking up to this danger. Interestingly, 29 countries all around the world voted against the April suspension of Syria's voting rights in OPCW. That's 29 countries who are very alive and sure to the danger that you just mentioned, that this could be just the beginning of how the international system is manipulated against them and not just Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The UK government has announced the removal of all public health measures, meaning that population immunity has to do all the work. With millions of people still without the protection of full vaccination or previous infection, it is inevitable that a good chunk of that immunity will come from new infection rather than vaccination. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Christina Pagel, director of UCL's Clinical Operational Research Unit. This article is published under the heading, Boris Johnson gave two reasons for lifting all restrictions. Both are wrong. Here's more on the story. There were almost 194,000 new cases of COVID-19 reported in England last week, which is 35% more than the week before. At the time of writing, 52% of UK population had been fully vaccinated. Perhaps another 20% have some immunity from one dose of vaccine or previous COVID infection. If this level of population immunity was enough to contain the pandemic alongside public health measures, cases would be falling. They aren't falling, and it isn't enough. So cases will keep rising, currently doubling every fortnight or so, until either population immunity is high enough or public health measures are effective enough, or a combination of both, to hold COVID's spread. The government recently announced the removal of all public health measures, meaning that population immunity has to do all the work. With millions of people still without the protection of full vaccination or previous infection, it is inevitable that a good chunk of that immunity will come from new infection rather than vaccination. Dr. Susan Hopkins, the head of Public Health England, estimated three more doublings of cases before the peak, potentially meaning more than 200,000 cases a day in 6 weeks' time. Even the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, concedes there are likely to be more than 100,000 cases a day, implying around two more doublings, which would be higher than the highest recorded day in January. This could easily mean another 2 million people infected before cases return to the low levels we saw in early May. Meanwhile, reports suggest the government is already planning for a fourth wave this autumn due to the return to school and university, colder weather, and some waning of vaccine effectiveness over time. The question then is, how much millions more cases matter, given the economic and mental health benefits of further opening? The Prime Minister set out two main arguments in favor of further easing. The first is that well over 90% of the most at-risk people are fully vaccinated, greatly weakening the link between new infections and hospitalizations. The second is that it is better to have mass infection now rather than in the winter when the virus spreads more easily and the NHS is more stretched. We think both are wrong. More than 100 scientists set out why allowing mass infection this summer was a terrible idea in a letter to The Lancet last week. Dr. Mike Ryan, the executive director of the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program, called such a strategy moral emptiness and epidemiological stupidity. Healthcare experts for the People's COVID Inquiry called it a dangerous experiment. The British Medical Association, Association of Directors of Public Health, SAGE, and NHS leaders have all highlighted the danger of allowing mass infection. First, while we are seeing far fewer hospitalizations than would be the case without a vaccine, hospital admissions are nonetheless rising exponentially. With two or three more doublings, we could be seeing more than 2,000 admissions a day by mid-August, a significant burden on a health service that is already under immense strain, with some hospitals having canceled elective surgeries and delayed cancer treatment. The last thing the NHS needs as it tries to cope with its backlog of 5 million patients is a return to giving up wards, and ICUs for COVID care. Second, the infections come with a high burden of long COVID. The Office for National Statistics estimates about 1 million people, including 33,000 children, currently live with long COVID in the UK, with 385,000 having symptoms for more than a year, and over 600,000 saying it adversely impacts their daily life. With infections falling mainly on unvaccinated young, we risk burdening a generation with long-term ill health. Both the Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, and the Chief Executive of NHS Providers, Dr. Chris Hobson, have expressed grave concern over the prospect of hundreds of thousands more cases of long COVID over the coming months. Third, every new infection presents an opportunity for further mutations of the virus, and any that can better infect the vaccinated will have a large selection advantage. We have really seen the impact of the Delta variant over the past few months. Do we really want to work our way through the Greek alphabet? Fourth, opening further has been billed as Freedom Day, but for many it is anything but. Those living with health conditions that make them more vulnerable to COVID fear a return to shielding indoors as they are no longer protected by low infection rates and measures such as mask wearing and physical distancing. As even vaccinated people can do and can transmit the virus, many of their friends and relatives, too, will restrict their activities to protect loved ones. For many, lifting the COVID rules will restrict rather than enable their freedom. Ultimately, all of this is unnecessary. People have safe and highly effective vaccines approved for use in everyone over the age of 12. There are excellent vaccination programs around the world. Evidence suggests that immunity derived from vaccination is more robust than immunity from infection, particularly against new variants. People could offer 2 doses of vaccine to everyone over 12 by the autumn, offering as many people as possible the protection of vaccination rather than the gamble of infection. The argument that delaying now will only result in more infections later in the winter ignores 3 things. The protection millions more, including adolescents, can have from vaccination, the potential for vulnerable adults to receive booster shots in autumn, and crucially, ability to offset the additional infection risks of winter with public health measures. If you accept that infections both matter and are avoidable, then it's not about further opening on July 19th, which can only make things worse, but about what we can do now to hold exponential growth and bring down cases. So, governments need to act quickly and act decisively with strategic testing, contact tracing, and supported isolation, including the vaccinated in all regions, learning from successful efforts in different regions. In this summer, a continued requirement to work at home where possible, and with short-lived restrictions such as a return to outdoor dining, if local directors of public health consider it necessary, and mask wearing made compulsory again in secondary schools. Any brief return to restrictions must come with financial support for those people and businesses affected.
Level, Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.